The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
It was actually an incredible experience because sometimes you go to a shiva, you know, where people are in mourning, and you realize you just have to be there for them in their pain. But sometimes you go to a shiva and you realize the people who are sitting there, they just want to be there for everybody who's come to visit them in their pain. And you just kind of felt like every time somebody walked into the room, one of the mourners, Elisa or her brothers, was like interrupting whatever was going on to introduce everybody to the new person who walked into the room. This is not normal behavior for a shiva. You don't normally like introduce everybody. And so after about an hour and a half, everybody's sitting, everybody knows each other's name. I felt like I was in an Israelite retreat. And the question is, how do you do that? How do you so access the moment? You know, we've been talking, and Rabbi Aaron's been talking about being in the moment. But a number of you have asked a question. How do you do that? I got an amazing story in an email. It was a terrible rainstorm, and this group was standing under the awning just outside of a Walmart. You know, it was one of those rainy days where the rain just pours so hard that it comes out of the gutters. Was anybody here at last year's Yom Kippur, Israelite Yom Kippur? Did anybody here make it down there? No? Remember this? It was unbelievable. It was unbelievable. I came from Israel. I was only in America like a month. And we're waiting sort of in the Israelite Center. We had this unbelievable Yom Kippur and then this unbelievable Shabbat. And everybody stayed for Shabbat Shuvah, and it was Friday night. And there were like, I don't know, 67 of us. And it was just raining. It wasn't just like raining. It was like God forgot that Noah has been dead for 4,000 years. It was just unbelievable, this rain. So me, the Israeli, you know, we're just, you know, waiting. Thinking like in Israel, it's going to rain for 10 minutes, it's going to stop. It's raining and raining, and everybody else is gone because they know that it's not going to stop, but we don't know this. Morty comes out. Morty is like the survival gear training prepared person. He's got this rubber suit, this yellow rubber suit, the yellow rain thing, and the yellow, he's got this hood, galoshes, you know. I'm there in my suit. No. Anyway, finally, after 40 minutes, I figured this is ridiculous. You know, we'll just... So, you know, I had the kids. Thank God Dorit and Yair didn't come. And we started walking home. It was only a 10-minute walk home. And at the end, there was no point to walking around puddles because you were just so totally drenched. I made all the kids take their clothes off in the front hall because it would be like taking the bathtub into the bedroom, you know? That's what this rain day was. I mean, the rain is pouring out of the gutters. So this group is just sort of... This group of people is just waiting, you know, sort of at the entrance to Walmart for hopefully the rain will abate, maybe so that they can run to their cars. And it's one of those instances where people who have nothing to do with each other have been placed together. But it's an innocuous, totally meaningless moment. They're just waiting for the rain. And the fellow writing this email says, you know, I love the rain. I love to listen to the pattern of the rain. And I got kind of lost in the moment, you know, just listening to the rainfall and watching the water pour out of the gutters. And there was this little six-year-old girl, red hair, freckles. And she looks at her mom, and she says, Mom, let's run through the rain. So this is one of those beautiful stories that you find on poems, you know. But, you know, the mother was like in the world, you know, and of it. And she said, well, maybe not today. You know? Like, I mean, you know, we got the grocery bags, we have to get to work, you know. Not that yet. So they wait another minute or two, and the girl says, you know, Mom, let's run through the rain. So the mom says, you know, maybe not today, you know, another time. So the girl says, but you said this morning that we could run through the rain. So mom says, I said this morning that we could run through the rain. What are you talking about? So she says, well, you said this morning when you were talking to dad about his cancer that if God can get us through this, he can get us through anything. So let's run through the rain. At this moment, everybody in this group goes quiet. And all you can hear is the rainfall. Now maybe most moms would have said, well, you know, I didn't mean that, whatever. But this mom, I guess, was in tune. So she thinks a minute and she says, okay, you know what? You're right. If God can get us through that, God can get us through the rain. And maybe if we don't get through the rain, it just means that we need to get washed. So they grab each other's hands and they start running through the rain and they put their bags over their heads. But of course, within a minute, they're completely soaked. And the guy writing this email says, you know, and a few of us just decided that we would join them on the whim of the moment. And so I ran through the rain with this mother and her daughter. And I got soaked because I guessed I needed a wash. And you read a story like that, and you wonder, how do you do that? How do you access that moment in every moment? Because it's all great, you know? We're going to be here at the retreat, and we're going to live in the moment, and we're going to tap into the moment, and it's going to be awesome. Then you get to work Monday morning. Hey, you're 5 minutes late. So you can't say to that person, but I'm in the moment. It doesn't work. How do you do that? And by the way, not just the moments that are so beautiful, but the moments that are challenging. And, you know, you don't have to go to, like, Lebanon or the army or the Holocaust or the World Trade Center. We have these moments all the time. I remember once I was coming to give a class, and I was going to teach up at YU, Yeshiva University, and I was actually driving a car for whatever reason, and I was looking for a parking space. I don't know if you've ever driven in Manhattan or certainly up near Yeshiva University, you know, in the war zone, and there are limited areas you can park your car, you know? I mean, you can see that there are certain streets that you park your car on, this window's broken, and that hubcap's missing, and so I'm looking, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and I had driven by a parking lot. There's a parking lot up there, and it's like $12 an hour or something like that. Finally, I see a parking space, and I'm already at the edge of, like, getting late to class, and I'm nervous that, you know, I'm gonna... So there was a double yellow line. It's illegal to make a U-turn on a double yellow line. Shem should forgive me. Had a momentary insanity. And I make this U-turn across the double yellow line, pull past the parking lot to back in, because I'm going to get the parking lot. And as I'm sort of turning around and pulling back into the parking space, this woman, okay, this car, drives in, and my car is sort of halfway in, and now her car is halfway in. Right? Like, I hear a screeching sound. She's made it in. So I'm, like, surprised, because, of course, this is my parking space. Right? I mean, I saw it. And there's no way that anybody could have been close enough at the time that I was already making the U-turn, so I had, like, acquired it by seeing it and taking ownership of it. I was in the process of making that real estate mine. So now we're sort of, I'm half in and she's half in, you know. And I see, you know, I sort of turn around and I look in my rearview mirror. There's a lady, and she looks like this. Like, I was just going to sort of make a sign, like, you know, like I was here first, whatever. So I see this lady, and she's doing something like this in my rearview mirror, like... So I know what I should have done. What are you going to do? We're all human. I feel like, you know what? I'm never going to find another parking space. Like, this is crazy. I'll just wait. I was here first. So I'm half in, she's half in. So I decide, you know what? I'll wait a few minutes. She'll get tired. I was here first. So I pull out a safer. And, you know, a book. I start to read. Now, I look in my rearview mirror, and I see that she's still... but I'm reading my book. And this goes on for 2 minutes, 3 minutes, I'm halfway, and then I say, you know what, I'm behaving like a three-year-old. Behaving like a three-year-old. So I said, okay, what are you going to do? So I pull out of the car, I wasn't with it, and I just drive around a little, whatever, actually annoyed at myself for behaving like a three-year-old to begin with. And I eventually had to park in the parking lot, and I get to YU, and I run up to whatever, the building there, into the base medrash. And as I come into the building, at the counter, at the front of the room, you know, the front of this hall, I see this woman. And she's standing there. I thought, I have to go over. And Baruch Hashem, I had like 20 steps. Because those 20 steps saved me from doing something silly. So I walked over and I said, hello. She looked at me, she didn't recognize me, because of course I'm just eyes in a mirror, right? And I said, I'm the guy, you know. Me, like with the parking. And all of a sudden her face turned red, you know. I said, no, I just want to say thank you, because you gave me an opportunity to do tikkun. Letakein, tikkun is, you know, you mess up and then you get a chance to fix it. But the question that I was left with was, how could I have tapped into where that moment could have been? I missed the moment. And whatever I do, and however I was given the blessing to make tikkun, I'll never get that moment back. So how do you do that? How do you tap into the moment, succeed in accessing what you want the moment to be, and somehow manage to actually do it on a consistent basis? Big challenge. So for me, you know, I look at things through Jewish lenses. There are certain stories, certain examples in the Torah that come to mind. And I'll give you just a few of them, and then I want to look at one closely. And I'm hoping, we'll see if I succeed, that we don't actually fill up the hour with the class, so that we can actually have a little time to talk about this and see what questions remain. So the most famous example that comes to mind is actually the story of Yaakov. Yaakov experiences this, either Yaakov or with his sons, in a number of places, right? And we'll actually go backwards. If you look at the story of the selling of Yosef, this is a moment that people miss. There's a very strange story. When Yaakov is about to enter the land of Israel, his wife Rachel dies. and his son Reuven does something. It's not clear exactly what he does. When you read the verse, it looks terrible. The Talmud says, anybody who thinks that this is what happened is making a mistake. But clearly something goes wrong. And it's so clear that it goes wrong that Yaakov, at the end of his life, actually reminds his eldest son, Reuven. And this is somehow rabbinically connected to Reuven, who is the firstborn, losing his position of being the firstborn. It's one of the issues. So what exactly happens? Vayi, Mishkon Yisrael be'eretz ahi. Vayelech Reuven, Reuven goes. Vayishkav et Bilha Pilega Shaviv, right? And he moves the tense is that he lays down with Bilha. Bilha is the sort of handmaiden of Rachel, and she is sort of representative of the house of Rachel. And now that Rachel, Yaakov's beloved wife, is dead, so Bilha has become the wife who is in the tent of Yaakov. Reuven somehow feels affronted by this because his mother Leah should be next in line. I'm sure it's not easy growing up being the son of Leah when Rachel was the love of Yaakov's life. By the way, I have to say something just as an aside. Bear in mind, when we study Torah, we need to look at these figures as though they're human beings. We need to examine Reuven and realize Reuven was a guy and he had mistakes and insecurities. Yaakov didn't know who he was. You also have to remember who you're talking about. So I'm not going to say this again, but just bear in mind, we're still talking about Reuven, we're still talking about Yaakov. These are people who talk to God. We're not quite there yet. So it's important to bear that in mind. But Reuven literally lays with Bilha. Vayishma Yisrael, and Yisrael hears. So the Talmud says anybody who thinks that this actually happened, that's not what really happened. Reuven actually switches the bed. He takes the bed, and there's a lot of room to suggest that this is so in the text, but we won't go there. Takes the bed of Bilha out and puts his mother's bed in. But that's still a very serious thing to do. To meddle in the affairs of the relationship of your father and your mother and his other wife, that's just, you don't do that. It's not right. So it says, Vayishma Yisrael, and Yisrael hears. There are cantillations in the text.
But Yisrael, you're talking about Yaakov?
Yisrael is Yaakov, it's not right. Yisrael, the father hears. It's interesting that he's called Yisrael. Yisrael generally represents Kisarita Melokim Vatuchal. Yaakov is called Yisrael because he struggles and succeeds. And there's one idea of Shimshon Falhurst suggests that whenever I see the name Yisrael, it represents the struggle. Right? He's struggling with something. Now there are cantillations, there are tunes that appear under the text. Right? And they signify the tunes that the Torah reader reads by. And one of them, which is always the middle of the verse, is called an etnachta. It looks like an upside down bell. No, it actually looks like a bell. And it signifies that you're in the middle of the verse. Okay? Underneath the words Vayishma Yisrael is an etnachta. It's the middle of the verse. Very clear. And then it says Vayu b'nei Yaakov shnei masar, and the sons of Yaakov were 12. Now this makes no sense. Just to read it all to you in a flow. Right? And Reuven switches the bed or lays the bed or however you want to read it of Bilha, and Yisrael hears, and the sons of Yaakov were 12. The sentence doesn't flow. It's like, I like peanut butter. Do you ski? It just doesn't seem to work, right? In fact, in an actual Torah scroll, and we're only one parsha away, so if anybody wants to see this tomorrow, I can show this to you. You'll actually see, in fact, it appears here in the text, there's a break in the text. In the column of the Torah, there's actually a break between Vayishma Yisrael, and Yisrael hears, and the sons of Yaakov were 12. Because Yaakov already, he's beyond being Yisrael. So one idea that's suggested is that Yisrael heard Yaakov, but he knew there was nothing he could say. Because anything he could say to Reuven might have ripped apart their relationship. So he doesn't say anything. And that's why Vayu Banav Shnei Masar, his sons remain 12. The family of Israel remains united. This is such a difficult thing. To know when to let a moment go. To know when to step outside of a moment. How do you do that? Because I'm not just interested in accessing a moment. I want to explore for a moment what different types of moments we need to access in what ways. So there's a moment that's so full of joy and so full of potential that I want to grab onto it. But then there's a moment that has potential for such divisiveness that I want to step outside of it. That's very difficult. I'll give you another example. The story of Aaron. Aaron loses his two sons, Nadav and Avihu. They are, by the way, the future leaders of the Jewish people. In the 24th chapter of Shemot, Perek Chav Dalet, it says that when Moshe goes up on Har Sinai and Mount Sinai, it says Moshe goes up, and below him on the mountain is Joshua and Yoshua, and below them are Nadav and Avihu, and then the elders. This is the future leadership of the Jewish people. And they're struck down on the day of the dedication of the tabernacle. It's a famous story. And Moshe comes to Aaron. And he says, you know, for this did Hashem say, "Bekrovai Kadesh, do those close to me, I will become holy, v'al pnei kol ha'am kaved, and in front of all the people will I become respected." Whatever Moshe is saying, Vayidom Aaron. And Aaron is silent. But it's not a silence of inaction, it's an active decision. It's a silence so powerful you can cut it. You've been in those experiences. How do I know when to do that? I'll give you another example. Yosef and the brothers. This is now a number of years later. So Yosef and the brothers are having the dream game. Right? Yosef is dreaming dreams. And the dreams are clearly about his brothers and about Yaakov. And he comes to Yaakov, to his father, to tell him the dream. But first he tells his brothers the dream. You know, there was a sun and a moon and 11 stars, and they were bowing down to one star, which was me. Now, you don't have to be a genius. I mean, duh. In other words, you're all bowing down to me. So this must cause you a lot of food for thought, but would you share this with all your brothers? And then he repeats it to Yaakov. And it's interesting that the verse suggests, Vayesaper el aviv ve'el echav. His brothers are standing there. He tells it to his father again in front of his brothers. So now his father is in a challenging position. Because you don't have to be blind to realize what's going on, but at the same time, you don't want to delegitimize a dream that may be real. So it says, Vayigar bo aviv. Yaakov scolds him. Yaakov lets him have it. But at the end of this verse, when he lets him have it, are you going to bow down to me? You expect me and your mother to bow down to you? But at the end of the verse it says, Ve'aviv shamar et ha'davar. His father, though, he filed this away. There was a moment there that Yaakov did not want to let go of. That's very interesting. Because years later, not so long later, when the brothers will bring a blood-drenched cloak of many colors to their father, suggesting that Yosef has been killed by a wild animal, and Yaakov refuses to be comforted. For 22 years, Yaakov lives not knowing. It is a whole different kind of moment. It's an endless moment. There are moments at least you get beyond. There are moments that are forever. You never let them go. You know, I have a very close friend. His name is Zach Malmo. So live and be well. He disappeared in the Battle of Sultan Yaakov. We were in the same dorm rooms in Gush, and he was one of the guys who took me under his wings. And I got very close to this family, Miriam and Yonah Baumel. They made Aliyah when Zach was 14. They live in Beit Vagan. And one year, his father called me up in Yeshiva, and it turned out that Schultz, who was then Secretary of State, was coming to Israel, and he was going to be at a ceremony, the end of Yom HaZikaron Memorial Day, the beginning of Independence Day, at Har Herzl. So he wanted to know if I'd get a bunch of yeshiva guys together to hold these big signs that you kind of wear on yourself with Zach's picture, and don't forget the MIAs. Zach is an American citizen. The case was running through the Senate. And just to be a reminder, he said, I don't want you to yell. I don't want you to demonstrate. So this was a very odd request because he had never asked us to do anything like this. Like, he had really come to the conclusion that the best way to do these things is the quiet road. Don't make a lot of waves. Don't undermine negotiations. He has since discovered it was a mistake, but whatever. At least that's his perception. So of course we agreed. So we went, we took the signs, we stood outside of Har Herzl. Schultz actually saw us. At the end of the day, I collected all the signs to bring them back to his house. And it was the end of Memorial Day. The transition from Yom HaZikaron to Yom HaTzmaut, from Memorial Day to Independence Day in Israel, is a very difficult thing. Memorial Day in Israel is not at all like America. I don't know how many of you have been to Israel on Memorial Day. It's, you know, in America, Memorial Day is like there's a few old geezers and they go, you know, to some memorial and they lay a few wreaths. Maybe this year was a little more serious, Baruch Hashem. And everybody else has picnics and sales and they get the day off. And it's actually a terrible day, at least the way I grew up thinking about it, because instead of appreciating what you're meant to appreciate on this day, you actually participate in forgetting. It's a terrible thing. But in Israel, it's a very powerful day. Everything stops. And the country crowds into the military cemeteries. And if you're driving on a highway, traffic stops, people get out of their car, there's a siren that goes across the country. One year I wanted to be at the corner of King George and Yaffa. I just wanted to see what it was like to experience when hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people in the busiest place, one of the busier places in Israel, just stops. And then when Memorial Day is over, they have a ceremony, and then they go into Independence Day. And as depressing, as challenging, as difficult, as painful, as quiet as Yom HaZikaron Memorial Day is, Yom HaTzmaut is exactly the opposite. People go nuts. They run through the streets, they sing, they have bands out, they spray whipped cream on each other. It might not be the way I would celebrate Yom HaTzmaut, but you sense the difference. And it's a very difficult transition for families who've lost a loved one, which is a lot of families. And there's been lots of discussions of it over the years. And I have to say, to the credit of the State of Israel, they have always stuck fast with this day, and I think it's very powerful. The reason that they do it is because before you celebrate what we've been given, you have to appreciate the price we paid to lose it, to get it. So I was in the Baumel's home, and I didn't want to just drop the signs off and leave. So I was sitting with them. And I watched as it turned into Yom HaTzmaut. And they had the TV on, and they were watching this whole thing. And I was actually watching their faces. And it was the first time I ever really got it. They had no day. Yom HaTzmaut is not a holiday for them. They can't celebrate independence from what? They're living with this. And they don't have a Memorial Day because they can't put it behind them. Because where is he, and is he out there?
What happened?
Pardon?
What happened to the boy?
There was a battle in a place called Sultan Yaakov. It's a longer story. But basically...
A battle with who?
A battle with Syrian tanks. And military intelligence made a terrible mistake.
This was in 72.
This was in 82, in 1982.
Okay.
It was the third day of the Lebanon War. Basically, military intelligence told them that there were no enemy in the area, and they had to go, you know, hell for leather, and try to take these positions as quickly as they could. Unfortunately, military intelligence was wrong. More accurately, it hadn't filtered down. And there was a company of T-62 Syrian tanks. And of course, they saw, because the Israeli tanks were told that there was no enemy in the area, so they threw caution to the winds. Those were their orders. They were going with lights on, you know, through this valley to get to these positions and this juncture of Sultan Yaakov, which was a very important junction. And they were told that this could hold the Syrians off and prevent large-scale trouble. So if you go with lights and you go with the radios blaring, you're much faster. And this company of T-62 tanks sitting up on top of this cliff sees this whole column of Israeli tanks flying through a valley. Middle of the night, it was unbelievable. So it was like a shooting range. And it's a longer story. I mean, if you remind me at the end of the class, remind me and I'll tell you the story. I don't mind telling the story, I just don't want everybody to feel trapped. But he disappeared. It's, by the way, very clear that Syria bears responsibility for the fact that he would disappear because Syrian troops were combing the site that morning. It's also very clear that Yasser Arafat knows exactly what happened to him because 2 weeks before the Oslo Accords were signed, he gave a half of...
the names of all the MIAs. You should get one. You should wear it every day. And
there's a half of a dog tag that was taken off of Zach, and it's not clear how Yasser Arafat got it. And he furnished the information gave it to Uri Lubrani of the Israeli embassy, who was negotiating sort of the Oslo Accords, and he actually promised that he would furnish information as to how he had gotten it. And 7 years later, he's still, 9 years later, he still hasn't done it. So that's another discussion. But anyway, my point is that Yonah and Miriam Baumol, they're stuck in this moment. This moment is an endless moment. And his greatest struggle, Yonah, and he said this to me a couple of times, I just want to let it go. I just need resolution. And I want you to know, this is all an esoteric, a theoretical, a theological discussion. I can't tell you what I would or could do in such a situation. Hashem should bless me never to know. But how do you do that? What is the challenge? How can you live in the moment, be of the moment, know when to let the moment go? And by the way, sometimes it's not clear what the moment is. You know, if you look at the story of the selling of Yosef, Yosef comes out and he sees his brothers. And if you read between the lines of the text, Yosef is all excited because he's seeing his brothers, and his brother, you know, Yaakov sent him out to see his brothers. And the brothers, meanwhile, are conspiring to kill him. And Hinei Bala Chalamot Al Azebah, this dreamer is coming. In fact, if you think about it, the fact that they can then, when they've sold him, take Yosef's coat of many colors and dip it in blood means that he's wearing it. It's not bad enough that his father favored him with this coat. It's not bad enough that they hate him because of it. Now he's all alone, he's coming out there, and he's not wearing it. And he loves it. He's all excited. He has no idea what this coat is doing to them. And of course they get him, and they want to kill him. And Reuven says, don't kill him. Let's throw him in a pit. Let's think about it. And the rabbis say that Reuven wants to go back later and he wants to save him, and that's a whole other story. So they throw him in a pit. Vayeshvu le'echol lachem. And they sit down to eat lunch. This is an amazing thing. Now the Torah does not tell me what Yosef is doing. But when you read Torah, in fact I learned this in Nachama Leibovitz. Nachama Leibovitz suggests that when you learn Torah, you have to put yourself into the mindset, as much as we're capable of the characters that you're studying. You have to ask, what's going on? Yosef, on top of the world, wearing his technicolored coat, favorite son of Yaakov, dreamer of dreams, going to be one day the ruler of the world because everybody's going to bow down to him. Sent by his father to be with the brothers, so now he's like all excited, he's with the brothers, they're going to finally be together. He's on top of the world. And a moment later, he's lying in a pit. And Rashi quotes the Midrash, quotes the rabbinic legend, you know, Mayim Einbo, Vaborek Einbo Mayim, the pit is empty and there's no water in it. So the Talmud says, well, why does it have to say there's no water in it? So this is Mayim Einbo and the Chashim Vakravim Yeshbo. It's true that there's no water in it, but there are snakes and scorpions in it. And if you ever spend time out in the desert, and I'm sure this is not only true in Israel, you don't find a pit without lots of stuff in it. It's not like this, you know, sort of relaxed pit, you know, of Hollywood. You wouldn't want to go into a pit in the desert. That's where snakes and scorpions lie. So Yosef is terrified. He must be crying out, help, help! What did I do? What's the matter? And his brothers are having sandwiches? And I want you to understand, this is the secret, this is the essence of the entire journey of the Jewish people down to Egypt. Because if you can sell your brother into slavery, if you can throw him in a pit and eat sandwiches, if he's all the way down there and you're up here, something's wrong. This is not the dream of the Jewish people. This is not the people that's going to bring a light unto the nation. This is not ethics as it's meant to be. Something's wrong. So the Jewish people have to go to Egypt to learn what it means to hear the cry of another human being. And by the way, the end of this story is that Moshe goes out into Egypt. Moshe, who is born as an Egyptian prince, and hears the pain of a Jew being beaten by an Egyptian. And then the Jewish people are ready to come home. So I always thought of that moment as a moment lost. But you know what? That moment is also a moment gained. It's very interesting. Because what's really happening when they're eating bread? You can look at that as an act of insensitivity. You can also look at that as taking a moment. There's another very different line in the rabbinic tradition, which is that the brothers, who were all righteous men, supposedly prophets and what else, that they felt that Yosef was trying to usurp what the Jewish people was meant to be. That because of what Yosef was doing, and because he was bringing their tales to their father, and because he was becoming the favorite, and because they viewed him as a liar and a cheat, and whatever else is going on in the rabbinic texts, that he needed to be excised. And maybe he was even worthy of death, and that's a whole discussion about inheritance, certainly before the Torah was given. And Reuven says, let's not kill him, let's sell him. And what Reuven basically is saying, let's take a moment. We're too much in the moment. We need to let go of this moment. Let's take a moment. Let's have some lunch. Let's chill. Let's go for a walk. You know, I once... one of the more horrible stories... It's a longer discussion. But... in a prison. And I have a student who got stuck in prison. It's a longer story. And I went to visit him a few times in Tel Mund in prison. And he asked me if I would come and give a shiur. And he was basically a boy who wasn't too bright. And he did a couple of dumb things. He joined the army. It could be a dumb thing. And somebody in the place that he was living convinced him that the yeshua of the place that he was living needed for security purposes grenades. So he thought that he was doing a big mitzvah to help protect the Arabs, and he brought home a few grenades. That's one way to look at the story. I like to look at the positive light. Thank God they caught him. This guy, you know, of course, in the end, said he had nothing to do with it, and he was sentenced to 3 years in prison. Now, it happens to be that he did a terrible thing, a very dangerous thing, and they were right to catch him, they were right to sentence him, and they were right to put him in prison. But at the end of the day, this guy lost 3 years of his life for a moment of stupidity. His parents, who thought he was nuts to be in Israel, who thought he was completely cracked because he was in yeshiva, now wanted to have nothing to do with it. They certainly weren't coming over to visit their son, the convict. So he had no one. So I wrote him letters, I said he was very lonely, I went to visit him a couple of times, he asked me if I'd come give a shiur. So I said, sure, of course I'd give a shiur. So I went to give a shiur in Tel Mund prison. It's an interesting discussion to have, you know, with your family. Where are you going to teach, Abba? Right? Okay. So we go to the prison, and, you know, of course you have a captive audience, right? I mean, everybody's there. And there's no time limit. There's no Morty, you know, 5 minutes, because, like, where do they have to go? And everybody's sitting in the room. And I said to them, you know, they say, can other people, sure, they come in, and great, it's a packed audience. And I had prepared this whole great class. It was actually on the sin of the golden calf. And then one guy, and I start teaching. I said, you know, about this and the moment of the mistake of the golden calf, whatever. And one guy says, Yosef. We want to hear about Joseph. Like, I have a shiur prepared. I said, well, you know, this is actually going to relate to Yosef. I start giving my shiur. Rotim Yosef. And everybody says, Ken, Yosef. We want to hear about Yosef. And then I realized, Yosef, he was a prisoner. Right? He was thrown in the pit. He was sold into Egypt. He was a prisoner. They wanted to hear about Yosef. I said, okay. We had a whole discussion about Yosef. And afterwards, the fellow who had originally said, you know, we want to hear about Yosef, so he said, Tov Ma'ariv, you know? And he had a very sort of a, you know, turned out he had been a truck driver, and he had that look about him. Like, he didn't argue with him, you know? A very big guy. And he didn't say, like, a Ma'ariv, if anybody wants to stay for Ma'ariv, it wasn't the Israelite, if anybody would like to stay with that. Ma'ariv, right? And he's standing by the door, nobody leaves. Nobody's leaving. The evening service. And he looks at me like, I'm the only one in the room he can question, like, you're going to stay for Ma'ariv, right? It was already like 11 o'clock at night, a long Q&A, my family's waiting for me, but okay, fine. I figured 5 minute Ma'ariv, right? So we start to play the evening service, we get to the Shemoneh Esrei, usually, like, if you're the rabbi, you're like, sometimes you're the last person to finish, you don't really notice. I could have read a library book, because these people have nowhere to go. And they're playing, and what's waiting for them? Their jail cell. So they're deep, deep, deep in the moment. And sometimes, I met a fellow, a truck driver. What was he doing in prison? You don't ask the prisoner what they're doing in prison. It's like the first rule they tell you when you teach in prison, don't ever ask what are you in for. They'll share it, they won't share it, it's not what you do. Why was this fellow in prison? Unbelievable story, he's a truck driver.
How'd you find out?
Pardon? That's a longer story. He was a truck driver. And he traveled the roads at night, so he always carried a pistol with him. And one night, he was sort of finished earlier than he thought. It was the middle of the night, so he figured he'll go home. He was married like a couple of years only, and they had a small baby. And he gets home, and I guess this was a product of his being away from home a lot, you know, if you're a truck driver. He gets home and he hears noises. And he comes upstairs into the bedroom, and he sees his wife in bed with his best friend. And their baby is in the middle. And he just lost it. He just lost it. And before he could think, he pulled out his pistol and he fired. He said, I don't know who I wanted to kill. I don't know if I wanted to kill my wife. I don't know if I wanted to kill my best friend. I don't know if I wanted to kill both of them. I missed both of them and I hit my baby. And he said, the first thing I did when they let me do this was I asked them to take the mirror out of my prison cell. Because I couldn't bear to look at the face of the man who killed his son. My son. Can you imagine? If this man could do everything in the world just to take back that moment. You know, there are moments that you want to grab onto. There are moments you want to let go of. Is there a difference? And there are moments that are so powerful that God himself, as it were, says let go in this moment. And I'll give you the best example I can think of. On Yom Kippur, at the height of our prayer service, we read something called the Eila Eskara. This is such a powerful prayer of the martyrs, the 10 martyrs, who may not, by the way, have lived all at the same time, but it's an allegorical liturgy, but the stories that happened to them did happen. And it speaks about the different great rabbis that were killed by the Romans. Chutzpah Samaturgaman, Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol, Rabbi Akiva, their skin combed by rakes, fed to lions, tongues ripped out, horrible, horrible stories. And not just horrible stories, but of the greatest rabbis in Jewish history. And could you imagine? It's hard to imagine what this did to the Jewish people. And at one point, the liturgist has the angels, Sorfei Malat Sakubimra, the angels themselves cry out in a bitter voice, Zut Torah Vezuschara. This is Torah and its reward. Oterka Salma Ora, will Hashem cloak light in such a dark cloak? The enemy insults, degrades your great and holy name. U'mecharefu megadefu divrei Torah, abuses, reviles, blasphemes the words of Torah. Antabat kol mishamayim, a heavenly voice comes from the heavens. Im eshma kol acher, if I hear another sound, efochet ha'olam lamayim, I will turn the earth into water. B'tohu v'avu, hishita domayim, I'll destroy the whole world. Gzeirahi milfanayim. Kablua. This is a decree, you have to accept it. Which I wonder, maybe means that there are moments that we have to step back from, that we have to let go of. How do you do that? And I want you to know, I think the question is not only how do you do that, how do you step out of the moment, but how do you help someone else step out of the moment? Because it's not only about getting there. You know, if you can access a moment and you can get there, and you're so full of joy, I mean, I look at, you know, I don't know, what we were talking about this morning, you know, the Sim Shalom, or the Modani, you start your day with Modani. The first word you start your day with is modeh, to be thankful. It's an incredible idea. If you could sit on the edge of your bed and just take 60 seconds to be thankful, you couldn't have a bad day because there's so much to be thankful for. And it's interesting, the second word is ani. Me. Before I have anything to do with God, do I appreciate who I am? Do I see the God within me? If you go through the process of modeh, it's an amazing process. One day we have to get this all on tape. But if you go through this process, you can't have a bad day. But if you're going through your day and somehow you tapped into what tefillah, what prayer is really about, what mitzvot are really about, and you're just having one more incredible day, but everyone around you is miserable, then what's your day worth? So it's not just about how can I access that moment. Is there a way to help others to access that moment? That's such a difficult question. I have a very close friend, Danny Moshitz, Hashem Yikom Damo. There's another guy who took me under his wing. Amazing story. He was killed in an ambush in 1984. And he was such a light. I mean, he was such a light. He was such a fine human being. He would sit up till late at night learning, and just unbelievable. In fact, there was a story that came out in the papers that I didn't know. 2 days after he died, he had called Rav Avital, the Rosh Yeshiva in Gush, the head of our yeshiva. He was very devoted to honesty and truth and ethics. That was really what he did, but he did it in a very fine way. And they were walking through cherry orchards. You know, in Lebanon, the cherry orchards are unbelievable. Like, especially if you're, this was the 19th of Adar, so it was the springtime, the beginning of spring, the end of winter, and the cherries are in bloom. I don't know if you've ever been around cherry orchards. The smell is unbelievable. And the Lebanon cherries are really good. And this is no man's land. In the middle of nowhere. So all the guys would walk along, and they'd do patrol, and they'd pick the cherries off the trees. I mean, they're minefields, you know what? So he got curious about this. Whose cherry orchards are these? Somebody planted these cherries, they belong to somebody. Just because now it's no man's land. It's not like somebody sold the deed to the Israeli army. Whose are these? So he called up Rav Amital. Now, you have to understand, this is not just like I pick up my cell phone and I call. Back in 1984, I mean, they didn't have cell phones to get a line to convince your sergeants that you have to make a call, to use that call to call Rav Amital, the Rosh Yeshiva, instead of calling your folks or your girlfriend or whatever else it is. So he called Rav Amital. Took him a day and a half to do this. And he got Rav Amital on the phone finally, and he asked him this question, halachically speaking, are you allowed to eat these cherries? I mean, what a question. And by the way, the answer that Rav Amital gave is no, of course you're not. Because these belong to a non-Jew doesn't matter, it's stealing, and he made it his business to go to everybody in the unit and make sure they didn't eat the cherries. It's an interesting halakhic question. Not so sure, but whatever. So you lose a son like that. So his mother is an amazing woman. And she was able, somehow, I mean, she's full of life and she smiles a lot and she's just there. His father has been a shell since that day. He's just stuck in that moment. And there's nothing anyone can say to him. He'll never be the same person. So how do you do that? So let me share with you one last story, which I think is the clue, it's the key to unwrapping this. If you could pick a moment in Jewish history when what we would consider to be one of the greatest role models of all really doesn't get it and loses the moment, who and when would it be? Let's see if we're on the same wavelength. If you could pick one of the greatest role models in history, Jewish history, Torah, who has a moment and just loses it. So it seems. Who would it be? King David. That's interesting. That's very good. King David with Bathsheba. He has that moment. He sees her on the roof. It's a good story. That, by the way, is a story you can only appreciate on the rooftop of Israelite, looking out at where it happens. They left to come and visit this summer, right? Well, we're going to chop you, don't worry, right? Okay. Hitting the rock. Moshe has a number of these moments. But I'll tell you the one that gets me. The one that Esther also has a moment. I'll tell you the one that gets me. You're upstairs talking to the big guy, big lady, right? You're up there. And this Hashem that you can't talk about so that you can talk about, right? You'll have to ask Rav Aaron. So Hashem says, you know what? You're a good guy. I'd really like to share, you know, I just wrote this book. And it's endless light. It's unbelievable, this book. But, you know, if I share it with the Jewish people, like, how much of it? You share it with the Jewish people. Of course, this is a very difficult question, why this is. But we won't go there. So I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you the basis of the book. I'll write it down for you. Notes. Right? I mean, you run to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and you say to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, listen, Rebbe, what's the secret? He says, you know what, I'm going to write you a letter. I'll tell you the secret to becoming an unbelievable person. So he writes it down for you, gives you the letter. So you come home and your kids spill something. You rip it up and you throw it at them. It's ridiculous. Moshe's walking down from Har Sinai with the tablets of God. I mean, this is an impressive work. Autographed. And the Jewish people are doing whatever they're doing. It doesn't even matter to me what they're doing. So what's Moshe's response? Moshe goes, three-year-old. What are you doing? What's the matter? Look at my parking space. It makes no sense. Right? What's really challenging about this moment is that if I could pick the worst moment in Moshe's life, I would have imagined it would be that moment, right? I mean, you can explain what happened, you can define it, then the rabbis talk about it, and maybe we'll get there, but I would think this is pretty bad. But that's not what happens. Because I'll tell you something even more amazing. You look at the end of the Torah. And we actually mentioned this in our weekly bite on Vazot Abracha. I know you all remember this by heart, but if you don't, I'll be glad to send it to you. The last verse in the entire Torah. Now, by the way, beginnings and endings are very important. They define. They create the paradigm. A good book, if a good book is well written, which I guess a good book would be, so the beginning of the book and the end of the book, they're the bookends, they're the theme. So how you end something and how you begin something is not just, it's very important. You know, it's like you're on a date. You want to sort of say something at the end of the day they're going to remember. You know? Don't waste it on goodnight. You know, like come up with a line, you know? And then you have your pickup line, right? You have to have that first line of chatzim, which is really ridiculous when you think about it, but it's not so ridiculous. Because you create an impression and you leave an impression. So this is the last verse in the Torah. Now I can think of lots of ways to end the last verse in the Torah. How do we end the last verse in the Torah? Ulechol hayad hachazakah, ulechol hamorah hagadol, asher asah Moshe le'inei kol Yisrael. And concerning the great mighty hand and the awesome great thing that Moshe did in the eyes of all of Israel. So the rabbis ask, oh, this is interesting. What's it talking about? What is this great mighty awful thing that Moshe did in the eyes of all of Israel? So what does Rashi say? Rashi says, Le'enei kol Yisrael shenas'o libo. I want you to remember this language. Shenas olibo, that his heart carried him, as he desired, lishbor haluchot le'inehem, to break the tablets before their eyes. Shenemar v'ashabren le'inehem, I broke it in front of you. V'hiskima da'at HaKadosh Baruch Hu le'da'ato, and God agreed with him. So the Talmud says, what does it mean that you broke? Yasher kochacha asher tibarta. Good for you that you broke him. Good job, excellent decision. You know, Rabbi Riskin once told me a story. Very interesting. A woman who was a teacher, took the principal and the staff or board or whoever it was of a yeshiva day school to a Beit Din. And Riskin was one of the rabbis on the Beit Din. What had happened? She was a third or fourth grade teacher. And one of the parts of her teaching day was she would sort of run davening. She would run the morning services with the kids, with the children. You know, children, I mean, they're not all like, you know, they get a little, the children. So one day, I guess it got too much for her. Kids were throwing paper airplanes, spitballs, running around, back and forth. Nobody was listening. Finally, she got fed up. She took the prayer book. She had a prayer book in her hand, a sidur. And this is like a, you know, a gazuk der firm or whatever you mean, school, right? And she took the prayer book and she threw it on the ground. So what's the matter? You threw the prayer book on the ground. Well, you can imagine the children see a teacher in a yeshiva day school throw a sidur on the ground. Everybody stops. And she looks at them and she says, if you could do all this, this means nothing. And then she picks up the sitter. Everybody got quiet and they continued davening. Well, the next morning, principal calls her into the office, because of course that night, there were 32 kids in the class, he got 32 sets of phone calls from 32 sets of parents. So they decided, they asked her, did you throw a prayer book on the floor? She says, yes. So they fired her. So she took them to a Beit Din, to a bit of court, because she felt that they couldn't fire her. What did the Beit Din find, and why? The Beit Din found that she was right. You know why? Because Moshe did the same thing. So it's a cute story, but what does it mean? And I'll tell you something more interesting. I'm going to read you these verses. You tell me the question. Okay? We're going to do a little learning. I'm going to read you these verses. You tell me the question. Okay? Moshe is up on the mountain. Listen to this. Okay? V'haluchot masei Elohim hema. The luchot, the actions, the act of God, the work of God. V'yishma Yoshua. Yoshua is halfway down the mountain. He hears the people talking. It's not clear what the sound is. Vayomer ein kol anot klura. Moshe says, no, it's not this sound, it's not that sound. I just hear sound. Vayihi. Now I'm going to read this. You tell me what the question is, okay? Vayihi. Kasher karav al machane. When Moshe came close to the encampment, he's coming down the mountain. Vayar et ha'egel u'micholot. And he sees the calf, the dancing. Vayichar af Moshe. And Moshe becomes angry. Vayashleich miyadav. And he throws out from his hands et haluchot, the tablets, vayeshaber otam tachat ahar, and he breaks them under the mountain. Again, vayhi kasher karav al machaneh, and it is when he comes close to the camp, vayar et ha'egel u'mecholot, and he sees the calf and the dancing, vayichar af Moshe, and Moshe gets angry, whatever chari af means, let's assume it means that, vayashleich miyadav et haluchot, and so he throws the tablets from his hands and they break at the bottom of the mountain. Moshe doesn't get down to the bottom. You know, like I would, if you're going to do something like this, I mean, you got to do it so everybody gets it. And I remember once I was teaching in a camp, in a summer camp, and there was a fellow, Murray Shaum, incredible guy. And we taught together and I learned a lot from him. And we went in one morning, we would go to different minyanim, and the kids, you know, the little kids, I like the daven sometimes the little kids, so you know, they obviously don't get it. And they're all talking during davening. They're all talking during the prayers. You know? Because, of course, we're not making it interesting enough for them. But it was really extreme. And, no, you know what? I'm sorry. It was an older group of kids. But it was really extreme. They were really talking. So Murray Shaum walks in. I was already in there. And he's like one of the camp rabbis. A very balanced fellow. And he's watching all this, and he just can't believe it. All these kids are talking. Just like, you know, some of the people are saying Shema, everybody's talking. So he walks over to the bima, and he bangs down on the bima. He says, you know, if God was in this service, he would walk out. And that was it. And then he walked out. And there was silence in the room. Because people have to hear what you have to say. So Moshe comes down. He sees from up on the mountain the calf. And he throws down the luchot. Go down into the camp. Get everybody. Go, what's the matter with you? That's not what he does. That's the first question. Second question.
Well, the words that are used to throw, yeah, actually, he sends them.
Vayashlech. Right? It doesn't say vayizrok. There's something here about letting go of something. Do you hear that? Not about throwing something. One more thing bothered me. I don't know if you picked up on this. What does he see? What does he see? He sees the calf. Why is it the calf that affects him? I would think, see the people. I don't care about the calf. That I could see people around the calf. That's what's causing me pain. He sees the calf. So the Torah Tamima, and with this we can put everything together. The Torah Tamima points out, the Torah Tamima was of Baruch Epstein. He was the son of the Aruch HaShulchan. Amazing, amazing individual. He actually wrote a commentary which is so worth studying. What he did was, he found pretty much every Talmudic text that speaks about a verse. So if you want to know what the Gemara says about a verse and where, you look up the Torah Tamima. And then he wrote a commentary on it. It's an incredibly scholarly work. But what's really amazing to me about this work is, and this fits at an executive retreat, he wrote this work as a businessman. He wrote this work just to prove to his dad, who was one of the great Torah scholars of the day, that he could learn a little Torah. But he wrote it while he was in business. He would take an hour here, an hour there. That's how he wrote his work. So he writes an amazing thing. He says, if I can find it, um, He says, what's really going on here? When God comes back to Moshe and says, "Psalach hashnei luchot avanim karishonim, yasher kochach asher shibarta," good for you that you broke the first ones. So the Torah Tumima says, "Mishum dekavanato haita letova." What Hashem is speaking to Moshe about is not what he did. Hashem was speaking to Moshe about what was behind what he did. What interests God in what Moshe does is not actually what Moshe is doing, as much as why Moshe is doing it. Now that's not to say that in the end what is important isn't what you do, but that what you do is wrapped up in how and why you're doing it. And there are many examples of this in the Torah. The best I can think of is the story of Pinchas. I don't know if you know the story of Pinchas. Pinchas was a leader of Israel. There was a prince called Zimri. And Zimri is literally adultering with Cozbi, the daughter of Midian, at the tent of meeting. It doesn't get much worse. That's eating a cheeseburger at the entrance to the temple. I mean, it doesn't get much worse. And Pinchas rises up, and he takes a spear, and he literally makes Zimri Cozbi shish kebab. And according to the Talmud, the Sanhedrin want to kill him because there's no court, there's no justice. But God does something unbelievable. He says, "Hineni noten lo briti shalom. I give him my covenant of peace." Because the only one who can ever say that a person is really intending what they're intending is God. God says, you can't know this, but I know this. That what he was doing was pure. So what's really going on here? So I want to tell you that there are really three issues here. And these three issues are the three pieces of a moment. The first is to choose. To make a conscious choice. You know, it's very challenging. Because you have to be in the moment, but you also have to be out of the moment. You have to find the balance between being able to embrace a moment and being able to choose how to embrace a moment. And there's all sorts of questions as to what Moshe is seeing. You know? What does it mean that the Jewish people are leaving Egypt? What does it mean that they're worshipping a calf? What does it mean that Moshe breaks the tablets? Essentially, the Jewish people came out as slaves. If I'm a slave, then everything gets done for me. Life is great. I don't have to make any choices. I don't have to choose. It's all given to me. And you meet people like this. They don't want to choose. There's something very easy, very simple, very uncomplicated about life takes me wherever I'm going to go. I'm sitting on a mountaintop, and I'm part of karma. And I just get on the river on my raft, and I float. And wherever I go, that's where God takes me. That's where the world takes me. So I have no choices, I have no responsibilities. I can do nothing wrong, and I can do nothing right. Because at the end of the day, there's no choice, it's all karma. Judaism says that's not so. Judaism says that I'm created to be a partner with God. And the Jewish people come out of Egypt, and they're given the opportunity to embrace choice and responsibility, which is very challenging. And that's why Hashem actually talks to the Jewish people. Hashem says, I want you to be partners with me in the creation of you. And then Moshe looks at the foot of Sinai. He's bringing them down the vehicle for embracing choice. This is the recipe for learning how and what to choose. And they're dancing with a calf. What is idolatry? Idolatry represents that decision not to choose, to let nature take me away, to worship nature and be embraced by nature. And whatever nature will bring, they're not ready. And if they're not ready, then the ability to choose is almost meaningless. If a person isn't ready to choose, if you can't embrace that choice, then you're not ready to choose. It's very interesting. You know, the Torah ends with the death of Moshe. Why does the Torah end with the death of Moshe? Why doesn't Moshe bring them into the land of Israel? Or at the very least, why don't they enter the land of Israel? The goal of Moshe was not to bring the Jewish people into Israel. That was not the goal of Moshe. The goal of Moshe was to create a people that would be ready to go into the land of Israel. And they were there, and the Torah ends. Because that was the success of Moshe. He created the people that were ready to go into the land of Israel, that no longer needed the miracles, that were ready to be partners in choice and responsibility. That's the first challenge of a moment. And you have to understand that part of the challenge of that moment is understanding what freedom of choice is. And the rabbis talk about this a lot. People think that the freedom to choose is in what I do. What I do is the result of my freedom to choose. But it's not actually what I do. In fact, we have this weekly learning, which I invite you all to join. Rabbi Aaron learns with us, teaches us. It's an amazing experience. Some of you I know are silent partners. I just discovered there are people who do this, and we don't even know they're on the line. But you should find out about this and tap into it. So a couple weeks ago, we were studying about this. And Rabbi Aaron, if I'm not mistaken, quoted the Rabbeinu Bachya. Rabbeinu Bachya suggests that freedom of choice is actually freedom to want. Koach ratzon. I choose to access what I want. Now, how does that work? And I remember when I went to yeshiva, I saw guys who loved learning. I couldn't understand it. I couldn't understand it. I had a Rebbe who so loved learning that he infected me in high school in 12th grade with the desire to love learning. Not Judaism, that I got from somebody else. But actually to love the Shita Mekubetzet and the Balamor and the Ramban and Talmudic text. But he didn't teach me to love it. He just made me want to see if I could love it. So I went to yeshiva because I wanted to want to love something. But I didn't really love it. And that was very challenging. And I couldn't tell you where that exactly came from. It's a gift. But once I knew that I wanted to try, well, that's a different story. You put in enough effort, and you'll love whatever it is that you effort to want. And that's the freedom to choose. I choose to want this. I choose that I want to want that. Big challenge. And sometimes that means letting go. To be able to let go. You know, I had a... And we're almost done. There's a story that that I've told some of you, I'm sure. And it's a story that comes back every now and then, and I think about it. We were on patrol in Beirut, and you know, it's a longer story. But they, one of the things that the Armored Corps teaches you again and again and again, they hammer it into you, is to be able to recognize enemy weaponry. Toda, that if you should see a certain thing, if you see a spot on the horizon, and you're a tank commander, you have to know it's a helicopter. And you have to very quickly be able to say what kind of a helicopter it is. Is it a Gazelle? Is it a Defender? Is it a Cobra? You don't wait until it's close enough to see its markings, because by then it's too late. Because, you know, helicopters, they pop up behind mountains at 4 kilometers. And they test you on this, and it's very difficult, because little specks, and you learn to do this, and every week they ingrain this into you. In fact, if you didn't know how to pass this test, you don't get out for Shabbat. And I finally appreciated this one day, because we were, you know, heading down an alley in Beirut, and I saw a tube sticking out from behind a wall. And to anybody out of view, it would probably just look like a tube. It's just sitting there. But you see it and you realize this is the thing I've been seeing in all these pictures. It's an RPG. It's not just leaning there. There must be somebody holding it. So I'm already reaching down for the mashbet. For there's an override control. You have to override the gunner. Right? There's a 105mm cannon. And the gunner is sitting inside the belly of the tank. And he's got a limited view. But it's magnified. So normally, if you have tanks all the way out in the distance... So you sort of bring, you know, with your override control, the mashbet, you bring his, sort of the gun more or less around, and then he has to kind of look for the target, zero in, he says, oh, and then he can fire a tank at 6 kilometers. But when something's that close, so if he's looking here and it's right there, you know, he doesn't know whether to go this way or left, you don't have time to show him. It takes about 1.25 seconds to fire an RPG. You jump out from behind an alley, you put it on your shoulder, it's already second generation, which means it doesn't have a wire attached, you don't need to keep your sight on it, you aim, you fire, that's it. With a tank that's 100 feet away, it's so big, you can't miss. So whoever fires first wins. And in that 1.25 seconds, when you're looking at this person jumping out, you also appreciate why the army spent so much time ingraining into you what you have to do in a situation, because the person holding that RPG tube is like a 6-7-year-old kid. They called them RPG kids. And they trained children to fire RPGs because they counted on officers to sort of have moments of weakness. And we lost a lot of guys. So eventually in officers' course, they started training us that you have to do this. And the base commander, Mufaz himself, sat with us and would not let us finish that particular day until everyone agreed that that's what you have to do. So you've thought about it, you've talked about it, you've agreed. So you know what you have to do, but that doesn't make it any easier to pull a trigger at a 6-7-8-year-old kid who you know is not responsible for what he's doing. So you know, I used to tell the story and whatever, and it took me many years till I could tell a story like this. And somebody once asked me an unbelievable question. Somebody said, well, that's all well and good. But my question to you isn't how you pull the trigger. My question is, like, how are you normal? And there are a lot of Israelis who have to deal with things like this, and they're normal. For the most part, people go through war. Most Israeli men have gone through war, and they're not all fruitcakes. And the army puts a lot of effort into this. And I'll tell you, personally, I was thinking about this a lot. The only way that you get through that, and it doesn't affect you in that way, is because you don't let the face of that boy fill your mind. What fills your mind are the 11 men in your tank platoon. You think about, I don't know, little Galai, who's this, you know, funny guy. I remember, in fact, the first time I met him, he was a private first class, he was one of my men, but he was like already a veteran, he'd been in the army for like a year and a half, and we have to do Tipul Shavui, we have to like sort of fix the tanks before we go out to combat, whatever, to patrol, and there's a whole thing you have to do. You know, you have to go through, like, you know, hit each thing on the tread and make sure it's not hollow, make sure it's like this, whatever. And so we get down there, and we're all doing push, and he's the driver, and I'm expecting him to do this and do that and whatever. So he takes out a hammer, and he goes like this. And he takes, like, one machbar, one, and he takes his hammer, and he goes like this. Psedo. He doesn't realize I'm watching him, right? He goes, stop, psedo, you know, we're done. So I look at him, I go, Gale, malaitcha, what are you talking about? You got to check the tread, you got to check the other tread. So he puts his hand on my shoulder, because in the Israeli army, there's no, like, I'm faked, sir. You know, it's like Bini, Galai. He says, listen. He says, I'm working with this tank, with Zelda, for a year already. We're good friends. He says, you got to understand. Don't mess with Zelda. He said, we had a commander. He did this stuff with us. And every time we started checking, this went wrong, that went wrong. Trust me. Let it go. Nothing will go wrong. He said, and I'll tell you what. If anything happens today and goes wrong, then I will do everything you say, whatever you say, and I'll be responsible for getting everybody in the unit to do everything you say for the rest of the month. But if nothing goes wrong, for every day that nothing goes wrong, you'll leave me alone. That's a good deal. That's worth the risk. Okay. Sure enough, that's what he would do every day. It was beyond my understanding. He would go up and he would like look at something and go, and that's how it would work. So you put a guy like that and his face is in your head. And what you've done is you've made a choice. And that's how you let go of a moment. Because you feel your moment. You choose what to embrace in your moment. And how to embrace it. How do you really sit in a parking lot and let go of that woman? You realize what a gift it is to be sitting inside a warm car. It's all about what you choose to embrace. And the last, and with this will end, the last is that Yaakov, when Yosef is discovered to be alive, I want to read you an incredible verse. I'll finish with this. In chapter 45, Perek Mem Hei, says, they tell Yaakov that his son's alive. And the Torah misses a whole point of this story. Because how do the brothers explain to their father that the boy whose technicolored coat was found drenched with blood is alive and well in Egypt? I mean, does the story get out? Commentators talk about this and no one knows. And my question isn't whether they actually told him. It's not even whether Yosef told him. It's did Yaakov figure it out? I mean, this was a prophet. So there's a beautiful verse. It says, Vayomer Yisrael Rav Od Yosef Bni Chai, my son is alive. El Chaver Enu B'Terem Amut. Right, this is the 28th verse of chapter 45, and then begins a new parak. I'm going to go see him before I die. Vayisa Yisrael, and so they go down, right? They go down towards Egypt, and then all of a sudden, Yaakov stops, and he starts offering up sacrifices. And what are those sacrifices? He offers up a sacrifice. Vayizbach Zvachim Lelohei Aviv Yitzchak. To the God of his father Yitzchak. And then Vayomer Elohim Yisrael, and God comes to him b'marot ha'layla, Vayomer Yaakov, Yaakov, Vayomer, and he says, yes. And God says, Anuchi Yael Elohei Avicha, Al Tira, don't worry about going down, I am God, the God of your father. What's going on here? And then when he's finished with this whole thing, Vayakam Yaakov mi Beersheva, he gets up, Vayisu b'nei Yisrael et Yaakov avihem, and the brothers all lift up their father, they take him down to Egypt. First of all, if you haven't seen your son in 22 years, what, you're taking time from Mairiv? I mean, what's going on here? Well, what's the whole sacrificial thing? And if you're going to do it when you see your son. I wonder if the one isn't the explanation of the other. It's incredible that the 11 sons of Yaakov bring him down to Egypt, that they remain one family. And I wonder if Yaakov isn't struggling and trying to tap into what that's all about. And what he does is he taps into the God of his father Yitzchak, the same Yitzchak who wakes up the morning after his wife switched his son, after his son was revealed as another son. And after that son became this son. I mean, what does that do to Yitzchak? And you never see in the Torah a word of conflict between Rivka and Yitzchak. Because Yitzchak is tapped in to the purpose behind it all. And I wonder if that's what Yaakov was trying to struggle with. Elohei Aviv Yitzchak. This is not about me. It's not about you. It's about something much greater. Can I tap into why I'm really here? What it's all about? What the purpose of it all is? And that's the second stage of embracing a moment. Do I remember what moments are really for? Yaakov runs into Yosef, and it says, Vayevkal Tzavarav. He cries on his shoulders, and the rabbis say, what do you mean he cries on his shoulders? Who cries? So it says, Yosef cries, and Yaakov says the Shema. What is Yaakov doing saying the Shema? Yaakov didn't want to lose that moment. He wanted to embrace what it was all for. And that's our challenge. Because if I embrace a moment, then I'm so happy. But it has no purpose. It isn't part of my challenge. It isn't part of my goal. It isn't bringing meaning into the world. I'm not tapping into why I was put here and what I can give back, then even while I embrace the moment, I've lost the moment. So that's the challenge. The challenge is to choose to embrace the moment, to make that choice, and as I make that choice, to let go as a part of that choice what I need to let go of, and to embrace the purpose for which I'm going through this whole process.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.